Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Graham Hutchins, and he will be speaking on the deliverance. So let's listen in on Graham Hutchins.
Oh God, you call us to praise and witness and awe at your mighty works. Help us to have eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts to sing. In Christ's name, amen. I had this professor at Edinburgh, an Old Testament professor. Whenever he had the prayer before the class, he was always getting his papers in order. Somehow I picked old John Gibson. Yeah, right. Anyway. Well, I mean, gee, as our tribe increased, last time we had two. My wife and faithful Vern.
Maybe this is the marriage bank.
Yeah, this is something like that.
Did your wife go out and grab
it? Right.
The ten
lost tribes have returned.
Sinners of all that.
Anyway, what we're looking at is to recapitulate, and for those of you who are new, figure out what we're trying to do here. A number of years ago in Edinburgh, I loved the Scottish Psalter, and my favorite selection in it, of course, was, as many of you know by now, or one of my favorite selections, was Old 124th, which really comes from the Genevan Psalter. Sometimes you'll find in your hymnals Geneva 124. But it was a strange psalm. And powerful. And then in translating from Isaiah for Hebrew class, Isaiah of Jerusalem, the first part of Isaiah, I noticed a strange correspondence of metaphors with that psalm. And I wondered, what was that psalm all about? And later I came home and pursued that. I went to Vancouver School of Theology and spent 4 weeks in research on this, and the more I found, the more it confirmed what I had sensed. This is what Vestermann calls one of the two psalms of praise of the people. It's a communal psalm. It's not an individual psalm. It's a psalm of thanksgiving for a crisis averted, danger passed, not due to any credit, you may notice, on the part of the people or their military might or whatever, but it is a great psalm of thanksgiving for rescue. And I remember this sung at Winston Churchill's funeral. A great psalm of rescue. What were the circumstances? Well, I noticed a correspondence, a metaphor between the metaphors of the psalm and a lot of stuff in Isaiah. And I pursued this, and so what I try to put together here is, I think it is a psalm of thanksgiving for the incredible lifting of the siege of Jerusalem under the armies of Assyria, of Sennacherib in 701 BC. Too many things are ascribed to the exile. I think this, that there wouldn't have ever been an exile or a return, because there would have been no nation if Assyria would have conquered Jerusalem. Even though they virtually conquered it, they were paying tribute to Assyria and all of that, but the city was never taken and destroyed as was the Assyrian practice. We have looked a bit at some of the metaphors. I want to go over some more of them. Today is a scheduled deliverance, but we're sort of looking at it all at once as we were. And so what we have here is a psalm that moves from disaster to deliverance to doxology. It is a psalm of praise and thanks of the people for an incredible lifting of danger, in which all they can do is humbly give thanks and rejoice. Um, And it's the only, and I pointed out that I have a principle of interpretation here that I think is important. As Moses Buttenweiser has said, the Psalms are not like epic poems. Though some of them name the circumstances out of which they arise, they generally do it, in sort of conventional terms. But it's too easy to write off a great national thanksgiving merely in conventional terms. And I pointed out such things as, even the Star Spangled Banner. It's not a religious song, but Oh Say Can You See by the Dawn's Early Light meant a particular dawn over Fort McHenry when the battle went all night, and are we still there? It's a similar situation. This, I believe, is a song that we are amazingly still here and grateful for it. And let's sing, let's go on with our metaphors, but let's sing the first two verses, or first. Yeah, let's sing the first two verses right now.
Now Israel may say, and truly, if that the Lord had not our cause maintained, if that the Lord had not our rights sustained, when cruel men against us furiously rose up in wrath to make of us their grave.
All right, now yesterday we looked at some of the metaphors in the psalm as found in Isaiah. And today, there's one we skipped over, however, that I think we'll start with right here. By the way, here's a neat translation of this psalm by Samuel Terrien. Where is it? Is that right? Where was that?
Union.
Huh? Union? No kidding. Well, then you probably know what he's going to say. But I like his translation here. Psalm, and he calls it a national psalm of victory, a song of victory. If it had not been Yahweh who was on our side, now may Israel say, if it had not been Yahweh who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they had swallowed us up quick when their wrath was kindled against us. Then the waters had overwhelmed us, the torrent had gone over our soul. Then they had gone over our soul, the waters of the raging flood. Blessed be Yahweh, who has not given us as a prey to their teeth. Our soul has escaped as a bird out of the snare of the fowlers. The snare has been broken, and as for us, we are escaped. Our help is in the name of Yahweh, who made heaven and earth.
Okay.
What I want to look at right now is, the first is...
Is that a translation from Hebrew, or does it say...
Well, yeah, it would be, huh?
Oh, okay, so he was translating from Hebrew, and it differed from this
here. Was it an accurate translation or paraphrasing? Mm-hmm.
Well, the old Scottish Psalter is a paraphrase, of course, but it's, it's got the... Where it says the Lord there, it means Yahweh. Just as in English Bibles, you notice that the Lord is sort of small capitals. Every time you see that in an English Bible, it means the name Yahweh there. In the Jerusalem Bible, it has Yahweh there. See, but that's the Tetragrammaton. And remember, the Jews would never say Yahweh. They would say Adonai. In fact, in the Hebrew, the pointing for the vowels or pointing for Yahweh is the vowels for Adonai, which meant Lord. And because they wouldn't say the divine name, you see. So that's where we get the term Lord. Anyway, to make a long story longer. When cruel men against us furiously rose up in wrath to make of us their prey. Who are these cruel men? And here again, you know, one of the latest rages in Old Testament study, and I'm amazed at Walter Brueggemann, one of our preeminent Old Testament scholars, who says about this psalm that the language of the waters we were talking about yesterday is just mythical language of the waters of chaos that the word of Yahweh holds back at creation, etc. Baloney! It says, when cruel men against us furiously. This is not the chaos monster we're dealing with here. It is a historical deliverance from a historical crisis, I think, that this song is celebrating. And so I'm sorry, Mr. Brueggemann, but I think you better look at it again. Of course, you know, they've asked to write books on the whole bloody Psalter, and they don't have time to look at each song. Anyway, so who are these cruel men? Okay, have you got Bibles? Somebody give them Bibles.
Isaiah,
as they say in Britain.
Isaiah, Jeremiah. Where are we going, Isaiah? Where are we going?
Okay, we're going, if I can find where I'm going.
He's talking to Ahab.
We looked at some of that yesterday. Dadgummit. Oh, here we are. Okay. Look at, for example, I ought to just throw this away and talk. When cruel men against us furiously rose up in wrath and made of us their prey, then certainly they had devoured us all. Well, first the cruel men. The Assyrian, Hutchins. What? Well, no, there's a, look, I think it's a chapter 10 I want you to go. Chapter 10. Oh, here we are. The phrase, when men rose up against us, in verse 2 begins to describe the nature of the peril from which the Lord had delivered his people.
Verse 2 of chapter 10?
Verse 2 in the Psalm. While it is not specific as to who these men were, of course, it is our contention that this psalm, this references to the king of Assyria and his vassal armies. That this is the case is borne out by the proud boast of the Assyrian as reported by Isaiah in the utterance found in chapter 10, verse 9. Somebody read that.
No.
Well, wait a minute. Somebody give me a Bible, will you?
24 looks better.
Verse 9 is full of names. I can't see.
Well, I was talking about this too.
In 19. The remnant of the trees of the spirit.
Well, actually, yeah. Well, this isn't even a flaming old place.
What's
by the Gideons.
What do you mean?
This is placed by the Gideons.
Oh, here. Sorry. Here. Who's that?
Gideons left that right out.
Somebody start reading chapter 10, will you?
Woe to those who make unjust laws.
What?
That's chapter 10.
Yeah.
Woe to those who
and the libels who keep writing oppression.
Right. Okay. Go down to verse 5.
Okay.
Assyria, the rod of my anger. Somebody read that.
Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury. Against the godless nation I send him, and against the people of my wrath I command him, to take spoil and seize plunder, to tread them down like the mire of the streets. But he does not so intend, and his mind does not so think, but it is in his mind to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he says, are not my commanders all kings? Is not Kamo like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? As my hand is reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her idols as I have done to Samaria and her images?
Okay. Stop a second. The point is that Assyria conquered kingdoms and then enlisted her subject peoples. They either conquered them or else forced their surrender, and enlisted even their generals to fight with the Syrian armies against other nations. And thus, it was a coalition of kings under the ruthless power of Assyria that... now, you know, this is stretching a point, but it doesn't say when cruel Assyria came down on us, but when cruel men. You see, and it's not just Assyrians, but it is a coalition of subject peoples who were conscripted to fight for Assyria against the other states that it was subduing. And so
that's why all commanders are kings?
Or are not all my commanders kings? They are kings that were conquered by the Assyrians and made to be vassal armies. All right? And that's just a minor point, but I think it's something to it. Our contention, this psalm is reference to the king of Assyria and his vassal armies. That this is the case is borne out by the proud boast of the Assyrian as reported by Isaiah. Thus we see it was Assyria and her willing or not so willing allies that devastated Judah and threatened Jerusalem. It could be that this lies behind the appellation man in the psalm. More than likely, it stems, however, from a characteristic that nearly all psalms share. As Moses Buttenweiser has observed, it is an all-important fact that the Psalms, being lyrical and not epic poems, describe events only inferentially and incompletely, often failing to state essential facts. All right, then, let's go on to, then they would have swallowed us up alive when their anger was kindled against us. Here the men referred to in verse 2 are compared to a cruel monster which swallows up its victims alive when its wrath is kindled by resistance. And remember that, as we pointed out yesterday, Ahaz cut a deal with Assyria, Hezekiah's father, in about 30 years before this crisis, around 734. He cut a deal. He thought if he could make a deal with Assyria, Assyria wouldn't invade him. Assyria, in response to that deal, Tiglath-Pileser, invaded Syria, Aram in the Bible, and its capital, Damascus, and the northern kingdom, Ephraim slash Israel. And so, in a sense, it was Ahaz's deal with Assyria that led Tiglath-Pileser to invade the northern kingdom of Israel. And there went the 10 tribes that are lost in the history. I mean, not just then, but in the years that followed. And so Ahaz was a real skunk. His son Hezekiah, and Ahaz, of course, we pointed out also, imported pagan practices and all kinds of stuff. And if you can believe the chronicler, the Book of Chronicles, both in Chronicles and Kings, he even sacrificed his own son during the when Syria and Ephraim came down to try to get Judah to be a coalition against Assyria. Well, Ahaz cut a deal with Assyria. Assyria came in and wiped out Damascus, and 10 years later or so, or a few years later, Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. However, Ahaz's son Hezekiah instituted political and religious reform, we talked about that yesterday, and rejected Assyrian domination, though they had been paying tribute since Ahaz to Assyria. This called forth the wrath and fury of Assyria. And they then marched down into Judah and devastated it. And so we come finally down to 701, the fall of the northern kingdom in 7, the fall of Damascus in something like 732, the fall of Samaria in 722, and now Judah is devastated and Jerusalem is surrounded, and Assyria reacted against Hezekiah, who instituted political and religious reform in Israel, similar to the Deuteronomic reform that Josiah later introduced. In fact, Assyria was mad. They were furious. And so they come back down into the land and they demand that Hezekiah surrender. And then Jerusalem is surrounded. And all the historical facts aren't quite clear there, but we do know that Jerusalem was not conquered by Assyria. And we did this dramatic reading the other night in the Book of Kings, which is paralleled in Isaiah, of the surrounding of the city and the demand for its capitulation. And Hezekiah, who was one of the few kings in the entire books of Kings who gets a good press, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He, under Isaiah's influence, refused to surrender. And then in one night, something happened, and the city was spared. And according to Sennacherib's own records, he did not conquer Jerusalem. He shut up the Jew Hezekiah like a bird in a cage, you remember. Well, then they would have, let's go back to the Psalm, verse 3, then they would have swallowed us up alive when their anger was kindled against us. Well, is the anger here kindled against us the reaction to Hezekiah's rejection of the deal that his father Ahaz cut with Assyria? Here the man referred to in verse 2 are compared to a cruel monster which swallows up its victims alive when its wrath is kindled by resistance. If we keep in mind that it is Israel here that is summoned to praise Yahweh, bearing in mind the rather fluid use of the term Israel as sometimes referring to the northern kingdom in a political sense, but no doubt more often and especially in liturgical usage as having application to the people of God, whether of the house of Israel or the house of Judah, all are in this sense Israel, then we may well ask the question as to just who these men were who in their proud and fierce anger were about to swallow up alive this people who now found themselves spared by the intervention of Yahweh. I think perhaps we may find a clue to the answer to this question by a consideration of the practice of Assyria in her nihilistic conquest of other nations, and also in the oracles of Isaiah concerning the events that led up to the crisis of 701. Regarding the barbaric practice of the Assyrian Empire, we might look to Isaiah chapter 10. Whereas Cassane has pointed out in his outline of oracles, Assyria planned to exterminate nations. Neither gods nor men can stay its progress. Okay. And you just read, didn't you? Aha, Assyria, the rod of my anger?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again in verse 13, we have some boasting of the Assyrian. I have removed the boundaries of the peoples and have plundered their treasures like a bull. I have brought down those who sat on thrones. Actually, the term bull there could be translated a mighty man or a god. Commenting on this verse, Skinner remarks, it was the policy of the Assyrian Empire to obliterate national distinctions, partly by welding the separate states under a single administration and partly by wholesale deportation of conquered populations. And this, in the view of antiquity, this was a violation of the divinely constituted order of the world. Now, the removing of boundaries, the taking of spoil, and the seizing of plunder, the obliteration of all national distinctions, especially the wholesale deportation of peoples, can easily be described as devouring or swallowing up of a people in a type of total warfare that is not unlike the modern world. The panic that this must have caused among the rulers and the people of the petty states of Palestine is well described for us by the prophet. If Syria and Ephraim would both go to war against Judah in order to force her alliance with them against the growing threat of Assyria, it must not have just been Ahaz and the people of Judah whose hearts shook like the forest before the wind. Assyria was known to devour those who resisted her policies. And it's no wonder that Ahaz was trying to make a deal with her. Isaiah saw, however, that to make a deal with Assyria would amount to the same thing anyway. What is more, the very fear and panic among the small states of the north had led them to devour each other. Look up Isaiah 9 now. Somebody read Isaiah 9:12.
Do not call conspiracy all that this people call conspiracy, and do not feel what they feel, nor be in dread.
No, that's 8.
Oh, that's 8.
9.
Okay. The Syrians on the east and the Philistines on the west devour Israel with open mouths.
Okay, and now
his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out straight.
Okay, and again within the northern kingdom of Israel itself, read 9:16.
For those who led this people led them astray, and those who are led by them are swallowed up.
All right. Isaiah watched, and Judah watched, as in the north, the threat of Assyria led these states to form little coalitions to try to protect themselves from it. Also led them to anarchy within and civil war and devouring each other. Look at here. Where's that little chart I gave you? Here is the northern kingdom, Jeroboam II, who reigned from 786 to 746, 40 years, was followed by Zechariah, the king of Zechariah, 746 to 745, who was murdered after 6 months reigning. Shalom, 745, assassinated after 1 month. Menachem, 745 to 738, accepted Assyrian sovereignty and paid heavy tribute. Pekahiah, 738 to 737, assassinated. Pekah, 737 to 732, reversed Menachem's foreign policy, put himself at the head of the anti-Assyrian coalition and attacked Judah, who had refused to join. That's the king who was, you know, trying to get Ahaz to join. He was followed by Hoshea, 732 to 724, who murdered Pekah and surrendered to the Assyrians. But at the death of Shalmaneser, that's the king of Assyria, rebelled again. And in 722, the end of the northern kingdom.
Had a tough being king then.
Yeah. Sort of like trying to run Haiti.
Watch what I eat.
I mean, anarchy. Anarchy and civil war. So read now. So even further in the passage, it combines the metaphors of burning, consuming, devouring, Divine wrath and human anger and the rising up of men against one another. Read Isaiah 9, 18 through 21. Would you?
For wickedness burns like a fire, it consumes briars and thorns, it kindles the thickets of the forest, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother. They snatch on the right, but are still hungry. And they devour on the left, but are not satisfied. Each devours his neighbor's flesh. Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh. And together they are against Judah. So all this anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still.
Okay. Manasseh and Ephraim are two tribes of Israel, you see, so they're in the northern kingdom and there's civil war. They're devouring each other out of their fear of the growing power of Assyria. So Judah watched as her neighbors to the north were consumed by anarchy and confusion and violence and civil strife. Even when Tiglath-Pileser, that's the great Assyrian king, died in 727, they misread the situation with false optimism and arrogance instead of repentance. The power of Assyria marched on and literally swallowed up the northern kingdom and its capital in 722, and as was the practice, deported great masses of the people. This is where we get the Samaritans. You see, Assyria deported many of the people of the northern kingdom, brought in other people from other countries they had conquered. They become a mixed population, and out of that came the Samaritans, who are there to this day, and still they have only the Torah. They don't have the prophets or the writings, but only the Samaritan Pentateuch, and they're still sort of like Jews, but not really Jews.
Is there, when I was in seminary, there was the word was that they didn't know what happened to the deported people. Was any recent scholarship in them?
Well, of course, the Mormons claim they came to Utah, and British Israel claims they came there. And
do you know recent scholarship? Has they done any more work on that? Is there any other evidence?
I haven't heard any lately.
All I know is that I was taught that they would sort of just disappear.
Yeah, they call the 10 lost tribes. Then Judah herself, in an oracle that is most surely contemporaneous with the crisis of 701, we read, and somebody read Isaiah 1:7.
Your country lies desolate, your cities are burned with fire, in your very presence aliens devour your land. It is desolate as overthrown by aliens.
Okay, here too we see the total destructiveness of Assyrian power. In a reference to the blitzkrieg pact practice of burning cities to the ground even when the population is to be deported. And so Judah too is being, quote, swallowed up. From Sennacherib's own records, we have an account of how he took some 46 cities in Judah, over 200,000 prisoners of war, plus great spoil of cattle and beasts, 800 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Thus our contention that the metaphors of Psalm 124 are rooted in Assyrian methods of conquest and the course of the events themselves and the prophetic announcement of it all by the prophet Isaiah may well find confirmation here. If we consider the peril which Jerusalem faced after watching gods, kings, nations, and indeed whole peoples being devoured by the robber empire of Assyria, then to witness the devastation of Judah herself, we can well understand their thankfulness and amazement that Jerusalem too was not swallowed up alive when man rose up against her. Okay, let's sing 4 and 5. It's a strange Old Testament study. You sing this all for one time. No, let's try 3. Then certainly they had devoured us all and swallowed quick for aught that we could deem. Such was their rage as we might well esteem, and as fierce floods before them all things drown, so had they brought our soul to death quite down. Some of this we did yesterday, but the mighty sweep of Assyrian power was likened to a great flood by the prophet Isaiah long before it reached Judah and Jerusalem. As Skinner has observed, Isaiah is capable of long views. As early as 735 in the Syro-Ephraimitic crisis, he was able to see the ominous threat of Assyrian power in these terms. The Lord spoke to me again because this people have refused the waters of Shiloh that flow gently and melt in fear before Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river. That's the Tigris, Euphrates, superpowers. Mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will rise over all the channels and go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck. And its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. In other words, to the west was the great sea, to the east was the river, and here the river is a symbol of the flood tide of Assyrian power that has swept away all these nations to the north and now is swept into Judah. Here the quietly flowing waters of the conduit to the pool of Siloam within the city of Jerusalem are contrasted to the mighty flood of the river, meaning the Tigris or the Euphrates, is a vivid metaphor of quiet trust in the life-sustaining power of the Lord in contrast to the equally vivid metaphor of the destructive power of Assyrian armies that sweep everything before them and overwhelm nation after nation in catastrophe. Thus the prophet predicts the utter devastating consequences of Assyrian power. It will not only overwhelm Assyria and Ephraim, but it will overflow and sweep into Judah and overflow again and pass on, reaching even unto the neck. And we talked yesterday about this even under the neck as perhaps an implicit sign of the remnant, because the head of Judah was Jerusalem, and the head of Jerusalem was Ahaz, then Hezekiah, In any event, and we talked about that some yesterday, and we talked about the sign of Emmanuel, this sign that Isaiah offered Ahaz, and Ahaz refused to ask the Lord a sign. Isaiah gives the Emmanuel sign. Behold, a young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. And we talked about how Emmanuel, God is with us, was a sign both of judgment and hope. Just as when Isaiah confronted Ahaz with his two sons, Sher Yashuv, which means a remnant shall return, and Mahar Shalal Hashbaz, second son he then had, were the speed spoils, the prey haste, were signs to Ahaz that he was going to get wiped out, but that a remnant shall return. And Isaiah's name, of course, itself means Yahweh is salvation, the same as Jesus. What's that?
It's a buffet lunch today, not even.
Yeah. Oh, we're through.
Yeah.
Oh, far out. Well, I guess that took care of that.
Well, not necessarily.
It's a freestyle
lunch. It's a buffet that goes on until
1:30. Oh. Oh. All right. Well, anyway. Anyway, we talked about the floodwaters of Assyrian power. Hey, good luck. You're leaving on the bus, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
You'll see you again, I'm always saying.
Yeah, right.
There you go.
Godspeed.
Let's see. Yeah, we did that yesterday. Somebody read here in Isaiah 10 again. We were talking about the remnant, but here's some more. But this is good. Read Isaiah 10, 20 to 27.
In that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean upon him that smote them, but will lean upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return. Destruction is decreed, overflowing with righteousness. For the Lord of hosts, will make a full end, as decreed in the midst of all the earth. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrians when they smite with the rod and lift up their staff against you, as the Egyptians did. For in a very little while my indignation will come to an end, and my anger will be directed to their destruction. And the Lord of hosts will wield against them a scourge, as when he smote Midian at the rock of Hor. And his rod will be over the sea, and he will lift it as he did in Egypt. And in that day his burden will depart from your shoulder, and his yoke will be destroyed from your neck.
Thank you. Here it is announced that Yahweh himself would act as he had at the Exodus from Egypt and lift the burden of Assyrian power from off the neck and shoulders of an oppressed people, the remnant. So the prophetic word was that there would be a remnant of a few survivors. That's what the term means. Isaiah 1:9 we read. The head of the body, so to speak. And this is precisely what happened in the sparing of Hezekiah, who, by the way, his name in Hebrew means the Lord is my strength. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem in 701. The word of praise after this event is that if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, if the Lord who is God had not been with us, if the Lord who is salvation had not spared us when men rose up against us, then the waters would have swept us away, the floods gone over us, and there would have been no remnant to return, and the waters would have gone over our soul and swept us away, and we would have fared no better than Sodom and become like Gomorrah. Look in Isaiah 29, read the first 8 verses, and you'll see again another oracle of Isaiah about this, an oracle of judgment that is later probably overcome by an oracle of hope, but they're in the same passage. And so somebody read Isaiah 29, 1 through 8.
How do you pronounce
the
name?
Ariel. Ariel, let me say first, Ariel is a name for Jerusalem. And there's a play on words here, because Ariel is an ancient name for Jerusalem, but it also means a fiery altar. Okay, read that.
Behold, Ariel, Ariel, the city where David encamped. And year to year let the feast run your throne, that I will distress Ariel, and there shall be mourning and lamentation, and she shall be to me like an Ariel. And I will
it's a fiery altar, see?
Yeah. I will encamp against you round about, and will besiege you with power. I will raise siege works against you. Then deep from the earth you shall speak, and from low in the dust your word shall come. Your voice shall come from the ground like the voice of a ghost, and your speech shall whisper out of the dust. But multitude of your foes shall be like small dust, multitude of the ruthless like passing chaff. And in an instant, suddenly, you will be visited by the Lord of hosts, with thunder and with earthquake and great noise, with whirlwind and tempest and flame of a devouring fire. Did this far you want?
No, through 8.
Oh. And the multitude of all nations that fight against Ariel, all that fight against her and her stronghold and distress her, shall be like a dream, a vision of the night. As when a hungry man dreams he is eating, and awakes when his hunger with his hunger not satisfied, or as when a thirsty man dreams he is drinking, and awakes faint, with thirst not quenched. So shall the multitude of all nations be that fight against Mount Zion.
Okay, now there's another that I didn't have in my paper, but it says the same thing. The title for today was Deliverance. We're finally getting to it. We see in 10 and in 29 this prophetic oracles that say that Assyria is the scourge of God to remove idolatry and corruption and injustice from the land, that God is using Assyria as the rod of his anger to punish his people for their sins. But then suddenly, God is going to preserve a remnant, and the proud armies and power of Assyria will itself be judged. And so here in this is an interesting oracle in that ho Ariel, the city where David encamped. He sort of talks about as if Jerusalem itself will become a burning altar, because Assyria will sweep down upon it and lay siege works against it, and besiege you with towers, and will raise siege works against you. Then from deep in the earth you will speak, and in other words, he's going to wipe them out, and they'll be like a ghost that is left. But suddenly it turns. But the multitude of your foes shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the ruthless like passing chaff. In an instant, suddenly, you will be visited by the Lord of hosts with thunder and earthquake and great noise and whirlwind and tempest and the flame of a devouring fire. In other words, aerial altar fire. First, Jerusalem would be like they were sacrificed in the fires of the altar, and suddenly the image turns that the fire on the altar would turn against their foes and defeat them, and they would be like men that dreamed. The multitude of all the nations that fight against Ariel, all that fight against her and her stronghold or treasure, shall be like a dream. In other words, here is a prophecy that the rod of God's anger, the fire of his wrath against them, would be turned back and consume their enemies. And indeed, this is something happened. Hezekiah was never conquered by Sennacherib. Jerusalem was spared. And we read when we read the play the other night, an angel of the Lord went out and slew, it says, 184,000 of the Assyrians, and they were all like dead men, and Assyria withdrew, and the city was never conquered. And Herodotus, the Greek historian, points out that tried to figure out, mice ate the bowstrings of the Assyrians, but all the historical records, biblical and extra-biblical, indicate that the city was never conquered, and it was an incredible lifting of the siege. And Sennacherib himself, on his records, says he shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage, but he doesn't say he conquered. He talks about his campaigns against Judah, but anyway.
When were these prophetic statements of Isaiah written in relationship to the Assyrian invasion?
Before it, during it, and after it. And it's hard to date some of them, but he did warn his people before, and within the crisis. It was 40 years, at least 40 years was the crisis, and his ministry lasted throughout it all. So in verse 6 of the psalm, we have an image of a beast of prey or a monster that tears and devours his victims, and the triumphant assertion that it is Yahweh who has rescued his people from this calamity. So the verse is a reaffirmation. Notice in verse 6, but blessed be God who hath not given us as a living prey into their teeth and bloody cruelty. Okay? As Yahweh has rescued this people from this calamity. So the verse is a reaffirmation of the praise we saw set forth in verses 1 and 2, or rather, it is the praise that is summoned forth in response to rescue from the deadly peril that has been so graphically outlined in verses 2 through 5. We might at this point recall what was said above in our comments regarding verse 3. Both the swallowed us alive and the prey to their teeth are not necessarily contradictions. Both express the idea of being devoured by a monster. In connection with verse 6, however, we might cite a marvelous poetic passage from Isaiah chapter 5, which many commentators maintain comes out of the Assyrian crisis. Read 5, 26 to 30. We read that the other night, but let's read it again. It describes this incredible army and how it devours. Reads 26 through 30 in chapter 5, would you?
He will raise a signal for a nation afar off, and whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And lo, swiftly, speedily it comes. None is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a waste cloth is loose, not a sandal thong broken. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows bent. Their horses' hooves seem like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring is like a lion, like young lions they roar. They growl and seize their prey. They carry it off, and none can rescue. They will growl over it on that day, like the roaring of the sea. And if one look to the land, behold, darkness and distress. And the light is darkened by its clouds.
Yeah. Such was the savage efficiency of the mighty Assyrian armies, and the fate of small nations or even coalitions of them was to be no better than the small animals of the forest when pounced upon by the savage roaring lion. Whole peoples are to be carried off. Notice that lion carries them off. Could that mean deportation? And none can rescue. And then follows a combined metaphor comparing the roaring of the lion and the sea. The pounding of surf is like the march of armies. The inevitability, perhaps, of both is expressed. It brings to mind the analogy of the flood of waters in the psalm, combined with that of a cruel monster that swallows up its victims alive. Let's sing verse 7. Well,
e'en as a bird out of the fowler's snare escapes away, so is our soul set free. Broke are their nets, and thus escaped we. Therefore our help is in the Lord's great name, who
is changed again to that of a bird caught in a trap or a snare, which then breaks and allows it to escape. One is reminded of Sennacherib's boast that he shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage, as found on the Tater Prism. In an oracle of Isaiah, we find the Assyrian making reference to the nations that he had conquered as defenseless birds. Read Isaiah 10:14, somebody.
My hand is, how far? Just 14.
Just 14.
My hand is bound like a nest, the wealth of the peoples. And as men gather eggs that have been forsaken, so I have gathered all the earth. And there was none that moved a wing, or opened a mouth, or chirped.
See, just defenseless birds, just like boys would steal eggs out of a, you know, so powerful was Assyria that they just sort of walked in. Or again, in Isaiah chapter 8, we have a passage akin to the one where Assyria is described as the rod of Yahweh's anger. This is expressed in terms of the metaphor of a trap and a snare. Read 8, 14, and 15.
And he will become a sanctuary, a stone of offense, and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many shall stumble thereon, they shall fall and be broken, they shall be snared and taken.
Okay. Here the Lord in judgment will set a trap and a snare for his people. Many shall be caught in it, but not all. And it is no doubt the case that the fact that a remnant survived caused a later redactor or to amend the Hebrew text at one point and put in sanctuary for snare. Many were caught and taken, but some escaped, as a bird out of the snare of a fowler, and survived as a remnant to offer praise to Yahweh for his mighty acts. We are escaped, was their astonished cry. And the "we" is emphatic in the Hebrew because Yahweh had broken the trap of his judgment by an act of his mercy. Here then is the praise of the remnant, that is, of those who have escaped. That's the title of my thing, Praise of the Remnant. This too was in accord with the word of the prophet. Read Isaiah 37, 32.
For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this.
Okay. Therefore, says the psalmist, our help is in the name of the Lord, that is Yahweh, who made heaven and earth. It is Yahweh that has shown himself mighty in deliverance. It is Yahweh who had shown himself to be the God of history. It is the name of Yahweh who gives specific content to the ambiguous sign of Emmanuel. Yahweh is the God who is with us. The gods of the nations were not on their side when men rose up against them, but the God of Israel, the Lord, Yahweh of hosts, was with his people and therefore is shown to be the Lord of history. The gods of the nations were destroyed by the Assyrian juggernaut. The Lord of Israel destroyed the Assyrians and their pretensions against the God of Israel. Therefore, it is in the name of this same Yahweh that his remnant can and must praise him, for it is Yahweh and he alone that is God, the Lord of history and the maker of heaven and earth. See Hezekiah's prayer, thou hast made heaven and earth. One more thing here I want to deal with that'll underline that. You got a minute? Huh?
Don't think that if somebody screwed you, all the elections already come. You may never know. That's what you're doing. Yeah. The bus
didn't come in yet.
Here. Yahweh had used Assyria to cast the gods of the nations into the fire, for they were no gods but the work of men's hands. This was in Hezekiah's prayer we read the other night. But what about Yahweh? Here we have the greatest crisis in the faith of Israel since Mount Carmel. There the issue at stake was who was to be God in Israel, Yahweh or Baal. Remember Elijah on Mount Carmel? Here the issue is who is to be God among the nations, Yahweh or the gods of the nations that are no gods. Behind both these crises lies the problem of the sole sovereignty of the God of Israel. Neither Elijah in Carmel nor Hezekiah in Jerusalem had any way out of the crisis had Yahweh himself not once again borne great and glorious witness to himself. That's Von Rahn speaking. In Hezekiah's case, it was not only a matter of political survival, it was a crisis of faith. The Assyrian was guilty not only of arrogance, but of blasphemy. Isaiah, no doubt, was a good teacher, and Hezekiah was confronted with a choice of gods, Yahweh or the king of Assyria, and he knew it. And so he prays for deliverance from the Assyrian onslaught, not for the sake of his political future, but that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou, O Lord, art God alone. O Yahweh, art God alone. We might say of Hezekiah here that he believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and must observe that the prayer of a righteous man has great power in its effects, or to put it again in Isaianic terms, Hezekiah believed and was established, unlike his father Ahaz, in the faith and for the future. His prayer as the leader of his people reaches a height that can do not my will but thine be done.